Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champions. In the studio this morning, I've got Clive Melanson. Clive, it's an absolute pleasure having you here. We've spoken about the energy transition for a while now. It's a fascinating topic and one that we're giving so much attention to in this current season of our podcast series. Welcome to our virtual studio, and please tell us more about yourself.
Thanks very much, Saul. Great to be here. Yeah, well, I'm actually a geologist by profession, but for some reason, my whole life, I've been interested in estimation, whether it's ore resource estimation, all sorts of estimations. In fact, my children call me the estimator. So if ever they want to know something that requires estimation, they ask me to have a crack at it. So in estimation, you have to take all the factors into account. You have to look at a full systems approach. And so I've always been interested in system approach to things. And of course, in geology, it's all about system approach. It's integrating geophysics with chemistry, with paleontology, with earth history. You're looking at a rich integration of all the sciences where the earth is your laboratory, and you're trying to understand how the earth works. And I've kind of gradually migrated using my, let's call them estimation skills, for want of a better word. I was naturally drawn to the renewable energy space, where estimation is actually much easier, strangely enough, than in many other cases. Certainly estimating resources much easier. But the difficulty has been the rate at which it's changing and getting people to understand that it's things like the estimation of cost reduction, the estimation of integrating these things together that actually becomes important. So I've migrated from geology, if you like, into natural resources, renewable energy resources, and how those systems work and all the systems around them. So the financing systems, the social equitability systems, all of that comes together. So I now regard myself as a specialist generalist, applying my estimation knowledge over many years of working in estimation to estimating the future of the electricity supply industry.
That's fascinating. Clive, I'm going to kind of dive right in. It's fascinating when you spoke about that estimation in energy is simpler than the field of geology. One of the areas in which we've been trying to, if not estimate, at least anticipate, is the degree to which new technologies are taking hold, you know, to the degree to which or at what point would solar, wind, storage, and particularly battery storage, all kind of come together. And one of the phrases that certainly stuck with me in one of our earlier conversations is when you said that, you know, 100% solar, wind, and batteries is just the beginning. I think it was a conversation we had around Tony Seba, and I know it's a fascinating person to have a look at his work, but that phrase alone kind of gives rise to new possibilities, right? If 100% solar, winds, and battery power all come together, and that's just the beginning, we're anticipating something quite different in the energy field. So maybe talk to us a little bit about that point of inflection when that becomes just the beginning. I'm fascinated by it.
Right. So Tony Seba and his co-workers have looked specifically at disruptive change over time. What drives disruptive change? And I think most people are aware of the big disruptions that have occurred. I mean, some of the classic ones are analog photography moving to digital photography, box TV sets moving from box to flat screen, of course, transport moving from horses to cars. All of those things happened in a remarkably short space of time. I sometimes try and remember when I last saw a box TV set and when exactly did that change happen? And so what they focus on, or what their team focus on, is how disruptive change takes place. And the key thing to understand is that disruption normally results in, first of all, it happens exponentially. So it's not a slow incremental change. It's something, it's almost like almost like the fear we have of what's happening in climate change, where people talk about tipping points. So in disruption, there's also tipping points. The funny thing about exponential change is that it starts off slowly and then suddenly creeps up on you and then it takes over. And when in many of these things where we've had this kind of change, a new system grows that is actually totally different to the old system. So the way we use photography these days, it's not just the digital versus celluloid photography. It's the way in which we use photography. It's not used anymore to simply capture memories. It's used as a real live interactive platform. And I tried to work out the other day how many photographs are taken per person compared to what was the case maybe 30 years ago. And the number is just staggering. So when this change takes place, the new system that grows often is much larger than the old system. And photography illustrates that very well. There's far more cameras. I mean, every cell phone's a camera than there ever used to be before. These disruptive changes lead to that. And so what we need to understand is with disruption taking place in the energy sector, there's a couple of vectors coming together at the same time. So there's an exponential reduction in cost, for example, of PV or photovoltaic solar energy. There's also an exponential reduction in the cost of wind, not quite as dramatic. I think year on year, wind is reduced by about 6% or so, solar by 15%. And then when it comes to storage, which is the enabler for us to transition to a completely new energy supply industry, the rate of reduction in storage, I think over the last 10 years, there's been a 90% reduction in cost. So all of these costs are reducing at the same time, radically. And that is leading to a massive disruption in the energy supply industry. And the new system that's going to emerge from this is once again going to supply far more than what the old system used to. And that's the exciting bit to me. So not only are we able to replace our electricity needs with wind, solar, and storage into the future, but when we do so, we're going to actually generate far more electricity than what we currently consume. And we'll move into an area of energy abundance rather than energy shortages. And I don't need to remind you what energy shortages translate to in the South African context.
In a number of other countries around the world. But, I mean, this is such a paradigm shift, and it really speaks to me about the kind of mindset that we need to cultivate and be courageous enough to look into and anticipate into versus trying to extrapolate from the current order. And maybe this is kind of a question that kind of jumps to mind as you were describing this, and that is, you know, Clyde, even at a personal level, at what point did you realize that was just the beginning? Was it a particular event? What made your mindset shift towards recognizing the scale of disruption, how big the new system might be, and how transformative it could be for us in an era of abundant energy?
I think the shift occurred to me when I got somewhat disillusioned with the natural resources game during the crash of 2008. I was at that time running a fund, an energy fund out of the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. And when the crash occurred, everyone pulled back from investing in small to medium cap exploration and mining companies. And yet it was the biggest buying opportunity ever in the minerals market. And I looked at this and I tried actually to get private equity to invest in some of the companies that we held stocks in. And everyone said, no, we can't touch it. And I just thought, gee, if the resources sector can't see that this is an opportunity, then I don't actually understand it. And at the same time I was running that fund, I also was involved in an energy fund. And so I looked at all forms of energy globally, other than oil and gas. I had colleagues who focused on oil and gas. So I studied the nuclear energy industry. I studied uranium. I studied uranium enrichment. I looked at coal across the world, from the Powder River Basin in America to the Bowen Basin in Australia to South Africa. So I looked at all of these things, and I also was always very interested in theories about peak oil, peak coal, and looking at cycles. And so I started looking at the decline or how coal was phased out in countries like the UK, countries like Poland, how it's changed in Germany, and looking at the sort of rise and then decline of commodity resources in countries that had actually gone through that change. And basically, I was also looking at renewable energy in that stage. And at that point, my interest was first sparked by recognizing that in the mineral resources industry, 90% of the risk sits with uncertainty about what you've got. In other words, you've got to drill holes to find out what you've got. And then you also have to sell into a market where you don't set the price. And so if you look at the minerals resource industry, 90% of the risk is tied up in not knowing what you've got and then not being in control of how much you sell it for. And I thought, well, let's compare that to the energy industry, and let's say specifically the renewable energy industry. Well, there it's actually incredibly quick and simple to work out how much you've got. I mean, I think you can do a quick solar assessment of anywhere in the world from quite long ago, from databases where you can work out the energy yield, in a matter of minutes, really. Wind's a little bit more complicated. You have to erect masts and things, but these wind atlases that have been drawn for the whole world. So in order to know what you've got to within, let's say, 5 to 10% accuracy, basically costs you nothing. Whereas if you're mining, by the time you've finished mining a mine, you still probably don't know within 5 or 10% what you actually had in the beginning. It's a very risky business, if I may say so. And so then I started wondering in the energy sector, where is the scope for innovation? Because, of course, when we started with renewable energy in South Africa, because it was new, everyone treated it as incredibly risky. And I said, 90% of the risk that you have in the minerals industry is missing in this industry. And so what the banks were doing was taking the technical risk and expanding that to cover the whole 100% of the risk. So they were taking the little 10% of technical risk that was left. And yet the technical risk in these areas of renewable energy itself is much smaller than the technical risk of sinking a deep shaft on a gold mine and having to extract the ore and process it. And even the technical risk of running a coal fleet, much, much higher. And so that fascinated me. And it started migrating me towards looking for innovative change in funding mechanism. Because the risks are lower in renewable energy, the rewards tend to be lower. And the opportunities for attracting venture capital, for attracting annuity income, equity investors, all has to do with how one structures the financials around the energy. In fact, it's how do you structure financials about something that's very certain, as opposed to in the minerals resource industry, it was all about getting punters to put money in at an early stage for something that was extremely risky. But of course, risk has two sides to it. So the punters in the mineral sector would like things that had a chance of being better than you thought. And so there was always a sort of risk and reward. And in fact, my thesis that I did was based on looking at Monte Carlo simulation and risk reward. So yes, it was probably round about that time, round about the time of the crash, 2008. And then because of my fascination with estimation, I just couldn't help myself. I built myself models that allowed me to model the energy situation in South Africa, the demand, the supply. I gleaned information. I got data sets from the CSIR because at that stage, Eskom wouldn't give them to me. And I built models. And once you have a model, you have a means of prodding and poking to see how the system works. And what most people don't understand about modeling is that modeling is not to give you a discrete answer. It's to understand how the system works. And once you have a model that allows you to understand how that system works, the best way to understand how the system works is to do things in the extreme. So you say, let's build a system that's entirely nuclear and see what it looks like. Oh, it does this, it does that, it costs this. Let's try one that's completely gas. And then you start mixing it. And when you do that, the answers pop out at you immediately as to what the cheapest, lowest cost solution is. And then, of course, you start researching the field and you bump into people like Mark Jacobson at Stanford and Tony Sieber at RethinkX. And you see, gee, other guys, other people around the world are doing this as well, but they don't have the resources that we have in South Africa. And so I started translating the work of others to look at what its impact would be on the South African situation. And quite frankly, the results are nothing short of stunning. We have the best interseasonal, interday resource base in wind and solar, I would say, in the world.
Clyde, this is so fascinating. And I guess what it kind of brings me to is not all countries are the same, right? When we start to look at these technologies, when we start to look at the resources that these technologies tap into, we find sometimes, to your words, surprising outcomes, right? I remember we were looking recently and got involved in the research into small economies and how some of the world's smallest economies, in fact, and some of the least looked at over a 20-year period, by focusing, by being very clear about where they could innovate and what type of resources they could bring to the table and cultivate and draw more talent into, over a 20-year period made a very significant advancement in their own economic welfare, in job opportunities and alleviating poverty, et cetera, et cetera. And resource certainly comes into it. I'm thinking of countries, for example, in Latin America, like Costa Rica, for example, or even Chile, although it's a slightly bigger economy. What was interesting for me is that the results were surprising because that's not where people were looking. People were looking at the biggest numbers. They were looking very often at the more advanced economies. And that's where often where smaller players, smaller countries, in fact, I would argue even smaller challenger organizations could play a very big role. So perhaps take us into your thinking when you look at some of these smaller economies, when you start to look at countries that on the outside may seem to be the periphery of the energy transition. But when you look deeper down, you actually found that they could become the case for, and there's a lot to be said for what they could contribute. So perhaps elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah, well, I've had a long love affair with Namibia, strangely enough. My first real job was in Namibia when I was a mill superintendent on a copper and silver mine operated by Falconbridge in Namibia. And so that was partially when I got into being interested in looking at a systems approach, because the mine management were often wanting to optimize the mining, but me as the mill superintendent would realize that the optimum for the mine didn't represent the optimum for the mill or for the smelter. And so you would often have promotion and bonuses geared towards the wrong things that would lead to strange outcomes if you didn't look at it as a whole systems. So the thing that happens often is people misconstrue thought experiments with reality. So when someone like me says, for example, we could run the whole of South Africa on wind, solar, and energy, and you know, we could technically do it tomorrow morning. When I say technically, we could have a thought experiment where we could say, let's see what it would look like if we try to do it tomorrow. And people then translate that into thinking, well, he actually wants to do it tomorrow, so he's going to shut down the whole coal fleet overnight and start a new system. And of course, that's not possible technically. You can imagine what it would look like if you were to do it. And so one of the things that comes up very frequently as a counter argument to being able to run everything on renewables with storage is, show me a country in the world where they do this. You know, who does this? And then you can kind of say, well, we're in the transition at the moment. It's a bit like saying when we were switching from analog photography to digital, show me in the country in the world where they only have digital cameras. And you would say, well, give it 10 years or so and I'll show you one. Yes, you see, so no one can do it just with digital. You'll never get away from analog cameras. And it's just such a silly argument, but it's one that irks me. And so I know that Namibia, for example, is a poster child country in the world. Namibia, within the space of 4 or 5 years, can go to be 100% renewable. And in this case, not based on something odd like sitting on top of a mid-ocean ridge spreading center like Iceland, where they've got abundant geothermal power and almost no people. Or I think Uruguay as a country is almost 100% renewable, but it all comes from hydro power. So this would be a case where you've got a large country with a relatively small population. I think Namibia uses about, it's about 2% of the electricity that South Africa uses. So it's tiny, and it wouldn't attract big investors. They'd say, oh, you know, one round of procurement of renewable energy in South Africa would be three times as much as Namibia needs to sort itself out. So they don't tend to look to Namibia. But boy, if ever there was a country that was, as I say, a poster opportunity for proving that you can run a country on entirely wind, solar, and storage, well, then it's Namibia. And just to make it even more exciting, Namibia actually have quite a good hydro record. So up in the north of Namibia, there's the Ruakana run-of-river hydro resource. So that resource can produce about half of the needs of Namibia when it's the rainy season. In other words, Namibia uses about 600 megawatts or so, peaks a bit higher, and it obviously troughs below that. But Ruakana can deliver about 340 or so. So it's about half of Namibia's needs when it's rainy season. So it can deliver 340 megawatts 24/7 for a couple of months. For the rest of the year, though, that drops, and it can only deliver either a third of that 24/7, or it can deliver that full amount for about 8 hours, because there's a weir across the Kanini River that allows a bit of ponding, if you like, of the situation. So you can build up a bit like a battery. You can build up anyway. So they've got that in the north. So it's almost like Norway has got the hydro. Then, of course, I don't even need to talk, I don't think, about the sunshine in Namibia. It's probably got the best solar resource in the world, I would say. You know, the might be a few other places, but they're stuck in the middle of the Sahara or up in Atacama, Antofagasta area of Chile, when all that's there is a couple of mines. So yeah, they've got fantastic solar resources, and they've got incredible wind resources as well. So you now have got wind and solar and hydro in a country. One doesn't normally relate Namibia to having hydro, but it does. And it's fed from the north by the hydro, and currently from the south by what I like to call an umbilical cord to South Africa, where it gets up to 60% of its energy still from Eskom. And of course, because it isn't Eskom itself, it doesn't have this big debt hanging over it. So it's debt-free Nampower, the local utility. It's got a wonderful water resource up in the north, and I'm not sure what's holding it back from doing it. So I looked at the work of Rethink X in America, where they modeled what it would look like to do 100% solar, wind, and storage in three states, I think it was, in California, Texas, and New England, of all places. And they showed that it was possible in all of those places, and that I think in California they needed 39 hours of storage, in Texas a little bit more, in New England a lot more. And they kind of modeled the whole thing and said, yes, it can be done. So I then looked at how they had modeled it and said, I'm not going to model it in the same way that they did, with thousands of computational iterations. I'm going to basically use a trick that applied mathematicians use, and you know, and statisticians. It's called Bayesian statistics, and you look at a model that someone else has done, and then you adapt that model to your situation in a far simpler fashion. So it's almost like discretization. Instead of doing full-on mathematical integration, you just chop it up into 100 blocks, calculate the answer for those 100 blocks, and it's so close to the truth of doing a full simulation integration that it doesn't really matter. And that's the art of estimation, once again, is to, you know, you don't have to go overboard. So anyway, in Namibia, they have an opportunity of, I calculated a thing called the clean energy U-curve for Namibia. Now, this needs a little bit of description to understand what it means. So when people were looking at is it possible to do electricity from 100% wind, solar and storage? The first question that arises is you've got to design a system. Well, the first issue that arises is you need to design a system that gets you through the worst patch in winter normally. So winter is normally when there's fewer hours of sunshine, the sun's often at a less favorable angle. The wind may or may not be more than it is in summer, but it's kind of not that different. And your cloudy days in winter are your big challenge. So if you're going to have a system that can get you through the worst patch in winter, you design that system, and if you design that system, you will de facto have surpluses generated from that system on every other day of the year, just by logic. If you've designed it to get you through the worst day, then you're going to have surpluses on every other day. And the work that Rethink X did, which was so exciting to me, is they said, right, so what is that system that allows us to get through that worst patch? And they said, well, we can either build just enough wind and solar with a little bit extra to put into storage. And then we'll build, imagine if you had infinite storage. You could literally harvest sunshine in the summer and release it in the winter with infinite storage. But infinite storage would actually cost an infinite amount of money. So that's not a very clever solution. So they then said, well, what would happen if we built more wind and solar so that we could have smaller quantum of storage? And they said, gee, it also works. If we overbuild, in inverted commas, wind and solar, to help get us through that worst patch, and then once again to give us even more on all the other days of the year, we can actually get away with shorter duration batteries. And the interesting thing is it costs less. It costs less to build more wind and solar with smaller storage duration batteries, and you get a solution that gets you through the worst patch. And then they said, well, what would happen if we built more wind and solar? And they actually developed what they call the clean energy U-curve. So if you can sort of imagine an XY graph, on the X-axis is the amount of wind and solar and storage that you build. And as you move to the right on the X-axis, you're building more wind and solar and having fewer batteries or lesser duration batteries. And on the y-axis, you have the total capital cost of the system. And what they found is that the point where a solution that gives you full security of supply, where you have the lowest cost, you de facto have a large amount of surplus wind and solar. So it shows the same traits of many of these disruptions where the new system actually produces more than the old system. So the lowest cost point is one where you de facto have surplus wind and solar. It's cheaper to build more wind and solar. And then, of course, this sparked my interest, and I ran models for Namibia to work out, well, where's the so-called lowest cost point price for Namibia, or the sweet spot? And it showed me that if Namibia today, tomorrow, or in the next 3 years, whatever, constructed 1,000 megawatts of solar, which is the amount of solar that is normally procured in one bid round in South Africa. If they constructed 1,000 megawatts of solar spread across the country, preferably distributed, 600 megawatts of wind, which needn't all necessarily be built in Namibia, but it could be. But it could also be wind from the Northern Cape in South Africa, where there's very good wind resources. The beauty of electricity systems is you can deliver product at the speed of light. So you're not constrained in the same way that you are with logistics of getting fresh flowers to market. So 1,000 megawatts of solar, about 600 megawatts of wind, and then 700 megawatts of storage. And 700 megawatts of storage would be sufficient to basically run the whole of Namibia on a battery if there was no sunshine and no wind at any point in time. And remember, in Namibia, there will always be something from Ruakana Hydro. So that combination would actually make Namibia 100% driven by wind, solar, storage, and water. Okay, so two questions then. How much would that cost? Well, my estimate is that it would cost approximately $2 billion to do that. $2 billion US to make Namibia 100% renewable. The next question would be, well, how much would that electricity cost? And the answer is significantly less than a rand a kilowatt hour. Much less, in fact. Probably more like 80-something cents a kilowatt hour. You say, gee, but that's a lot cheaper than people are paying for electricity in Namibia at the moment. And I said, well, that's the interesting bit. Then the third question is...
Put it into global perspectives, that's about 6 American cents. Per kilowatt hour, and
it would between 5 and 6 cents US a kilowatt hour.
Exactly, and if we start to see how the curves continue to fall, we're looking at examples, real examples now in California, for example, of some between 3.5 and 4. So the more the technology advances, the more these numbers even become better. But to your good point, it is already more than competitive, right? It is already a very compelling proposition.
Absolutely. And of course, a country like Namibia, because if we do this, there will be a de facto surplus. Remember, if we pick the sweet spot or the cheapest point on that curve, we de facto. So in Namibia, when I constructed the clean energy U-curve for Namibia, there's about 40% additional electricity than what Namibia currently consumes that is generated from the cheapest capital cost system. And you say, oh, well, what's going to happen to that? It's going to get wasted or curtailed. And I say, no, you can export that as a country. You can use it for aspirations for green hydrogen export. You can use it to transform your transport sector to e-mobility. That surplus is the big opportunity. It's the really exciting bit is not how do we curtail excess, but how do we build business opportunities on what is essentially, in this case, zero marginal cost additional electricity that comes de facto from designing the cheapest system to get you through the worst patch in winter. And you will have those surpluses on virtually every other day of the year. What really gets me going then is that if you choose then to build even more wind and solar and further decrease the size of your battery, the amount of additional power that gets generated relative to the increase in capital cost is not linear. In other words, the clean energy U-curve has got quite a flat bottom to it. So shifting to a higher output of wind and solar doesn't result in an equivalent amount of required additional capital spend. So you can, for example, spend 20% extra capital and get as much as 100% extra surplus power. Mm. And boy, isn't that an exciting thing, because you now can go and say, we can now produce the cheapest green hydrogen in the world because we've done it in conjunction with supplying electricity to the whole country at cheap prices at the same time. And you can only do that because it's a relatively small electricity economy. You can actually leverage it in that fashion, where you can develop the renewable for the existing electricity economy at the same time as harvesting surpluses for new business opportunities.
Now, Clyde, I've got to ask this, you know, with that context, one of the areas we've been looking into is the role of innovation in this. And the shift that's taking place from just technological innovation, which a lot has gone into and still does, if I think of battery storage, for example, if I think of digitization of the grid, et cetera, there's still lots of scope for innovation there. But equally, the center of gravity seems to shift into innovation in how we fund this new system, in how it gets regulated, in how others could participate in the system and build economic opportunity. The scope for innovation here seems almost unlimited, and it's much broader than what we thought it would be 20 years ago, when we were just trying to find the right technical solution to demonstrate the value of solar, wind, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Well, I like to think that the changes, the sea change taking place in the electricity supply industry can actually lead to a sea change in transforming the socio-economic and socio-political situation in a country. So the most exciting thing to me is that you're building this new system with a built-in saving of basic electricity cost. People are already buying electricity at higher prices, so there's a demand for it, and you're now able to produce at a level which cuts that cost in half. But the people producing the electricity, or the power producers producing that electricity, selling it at that lower price, are making sufficient returns to make them interested. So you've got a situation I've never quite seen before, where you're really saying this saving of 50%, given that the people who own the wind and the solar farms are actually getting very good returns. In fact, they're getting returns that are better than are often given by typical pension funds. So this is, I sometimes call it pension fund heaven. You can actually socially engineer and say, how much would the pension funds like to get from investing on behalf of their beneficiaries into wind and solar, let's say in Namibia? What kind of returns will make you happy? And the guys will say, well, you know, long-term returns, we would like CPI plus 3% or whatever it happens to be. And you say, right, we can do that. And we still are able to supply electricity at half the price that's currently being paid. So it becomes a question then of not how do we afford this, but how do we equitably distribute the benefits that we're going to reap by lower cost, abundant electricity. And this is where I think that the sector has an opportunity of transforming economies in countries that may have liberalized politically, but still in many cases haven't transformed their economies. And there's really an opportunity here for every Namibian of a certain age or every Namibian homeowner or whatever to invest in this new fleet, so that the ownership of this new fleet, the 1,000 megawatts of solar, the 600 megawatts of wind, the 700 megawatts of storage, it would actually be owned by the people, and the dividends flowing from those assets would flow to the people of Namibia. And you would then say, who's gonna own the equity? And you say, well, whoever owns the equity, because we're now actually talking about owning the debt or owning, you know, it's good debt. You've borrowed money perhaps to invest in a solar farm, and you're getting dividends from the solar farm that are more than sufficient to allow you to pay back whatever you've borrowed. So it's like getting a bond, buying a flat, renting it out, and getting a rental income that exceeds what your bond repayments are from day one, basically. So you've got that opportunity. Then the country is going to have, you're going to pay less for electricity. There's an opportunity here to bring a whole new groups of people in a country into the bond markets, if I may call it that, that previously you have been excluded from those markets. And it's not just a vision, it's physically possible to imagine that in 10 to 15 years' time, every Namibian will be getting renewable energy dividends in the same way that every Norwegian gets a nice pension the day they're born from profits extracted from North Sea oil primarily. So I've never seen an opportunity where you actually are able to socially engineer how you divvy up the savings that are possible. And the role then of the so-called equity owners, or the actual owners of these fleet, is really that they must be competent, they must run it competently, they must ensure that it's connected to the grid, they must keep the grid operating. If they do all of that well, there's still plenty of spare juice left in the system to give them sufficient reward to be able to further improve the delivery of services of electricity to the people of Namibia.
Right, this is so important, and I guess what you're alluding to as you were describing what this future state would look like is also that shift in mindset from essentially being a recipient of a social grant, government support, without the economic opportunity that comes with it, to becoming an asset owner, to be able to even possibly leverage that as people have done with property ownership, for example. And there's such good examples around the world of that. If I think of Singapore, for example, and many other countries who've used that to have the population grow from low to middle income and ultimately to prosper. So this is such a relevant conversation.
Imagine your pride if you popped your friends into your electric vehicle, which you had charged at a solar plant where you actually owned a big chunk of the panels, and you could actually take them there and hang over the fence and point to those panels and say, you see those panels there? Those are mine.
Exactly. Clyde, maybe just a last question. I know we're getting to the final part of our conversation, and that is, you know, in order to make these changes, in order to bring this level of innovation into the system, we need a mix of both people who understand the system. You spoke about modeling earlier. You spoke about the role of modeling in understanding the system. Any people who would challenge the system, who would be able to bring a new voice, who would be able to innovate and drive new solutions unhindered by the old mindset. And that very often brings me to an area I'm passionate about, which is the role of the youth, the role of young people entering the industry, the workforce, the financial industry, which is going to be play a pivotal part in this. What would be some of the lessons that you would want to leave with them? What would you want to tell them in terms of what is possible and how could they make themselves contribute even more into this energy transition?
A very difficult question, actually. The thing that drives me mostly is a passion for lifelong learning. So you can't be entrepreneurial without continued learning. And, you know, it's a bit of a cliche. My problem is perhaps that I often see things before they actually become commercially viable. So I won't go into details there, but it can be quite frustrating when you can clearly see that there's a pathway to something fantastic, but the blockages are in conveying the message to others. That's almost the biggest challenge. So one of the things I read somewhere recently that resonated with me is tell your story over and over and over again until you wear people down. And I think the quote ended with saying it's like water on granite. And being a geologist, I know that you've got to run water over granite for a very, very long time to wear it down and shape it to understand what's possible. So the real challenges are to find ways of conveying the possibilities of what you're doing, whatever it happens to be, to the decision makers. And I'll be quite frank with you. I would rate it as 100 times easier to get the youth to understand the possibility of this future compared to people who actually perhaps have a 40-year career industry in the power sector. It's most difficult to persuade incumbents of the change that's taking place because they either don't want to see it or just can't get their heads around it. And you only have to think of Kodak as the example of that, where in the late 1990s, they were one of the top S&P 500 companies. And 12 years later, they were filing for bankruptcy. And their problem was that they just couldn't see what the business model for digital photography was because they sold chemicals to develop spools. So to the youth, I would say the opportunities in the energy sector in particular, and in the climate mitigation sector, and in the financial structuring to enable this are almost limitless. But you need to have more than passion. You need to, if you're going to sell it to the current decision makers, you need to have absolute confidence that you've got a good vacuum cleaner. And the nice thing about systems modeling is it gives you the confidence that you know that it's possible. And only by knowing that it's possible can you put all of your effort into conveying that message that it is possible. And so the only thing holding us back at the moment, certainly in South Africa, is leadership and understanding by leadership of what the possibilities are. We're trying to fix problems of lack of electricity with old, we're trying to fix it. We're trying to fix symptoms rather than go to cause and look at whole new possibilities. So I actually wrote a paper called Dancing to the New Generation, where I said that in the future, at the moment, our demand for electricity drives all our thinking, and we're trying to plug that demand gap with, you know, whether it be gas or nuclear or whatever. We're trying to plug that gap. In the future, the generation profile of the wind and solar with the storage is going to determine how we operate, and our new demand centers like e-mobility and green hydrogen are going to adapt themselves to the generation profile rather than us trying to generate to meet the demand profile. And so to the new generation, there's a wonderful opportunity of looking for business opportunities that can adapt themselves to a abundance of low marginal cost excess energy.
Like, I must say, fascinating conversation. Really, thank you for making the time for this and kind of sharing from your own work and interactions with others along the energy transition. You've been at this for a long while, and really just wanted to say thank you again from sharing all these insights with us.
It's been my pleasure. Now let's make it happen.
Absolutely. Thank you, Clyde.
Right. Cheers.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.